Josh and Frankie.
What a couple of dumb shits.
Primates! You found Primus Trax, congratulations! You can also find us on the wonderful world of the internet at Primus Trax on Instagram and Twitter. Primus Trax Pod is the email address. I am Josh. As far as I know, he doesn't feed his face with cheddar balls. It's Frankie!
Hi, Josh.
Oh, hey, loud and clear coming from Primus Trax Towers. We also have another guest today. Today we're talking about Moron TV. I believe it's track 9 from Green Naugahyde. Today's guest, this one's famous for his bass skills, and it's another new addition to the Primus Trax family. 2 weeks in a row, Frankie! This time, I'm happy to welcome to the Primus Trax family, Blaz Perez! Welcome to Primus Trax, man!
Thanks, guys! Fun to be here!
Hi, Blaz!
Yes, yeah. Sir! Oh, man! So, Blaz, I've seen your Fender videos. You play with the kid of a Beatle, but I want you to introduce yourself to the Primus Trax family because you are quite, I would say, intriguing addition to the Primus Trax family. So let's start with you, man. Tell us about your background and bass credentials. And of course, after that, I'll ask about your path to Primus.
Well, bass credentials, I guess. yeah, like you said, I play with Danny Harrison. I've been playing with him for, well, geez, we lost a couple years there.
Right.
So maybe like 4 or 5 years now I've been with Danny. Yeah, done a couple tours with him, and you know, I also play in another band called Big Black Delta, which is kind of like an electronic kind of bass band. We'll be doing some shows, you know, coming up in a couple months. I think we'll be doing some shows. That's about it. That as far as playing with people right now, that's Danny Harrison, Big Black Delta.
Nice, man. Did you start with the bass guitar, and did you start as a little guy and just plunk away and work away at it? How'd that work for you?
Technically, I did start on guitar, but soon after, my brother was, I have 5 older brothers, and oh, wow, the brother that's like right up next to me, he's a drummer, and he's, I'd say, like 5 years older than me. He already had a drum set, and he had friends that played guitar, and he's like, hey, well, why don't you just get a bass? Because we don't know anybody who plays bass. To have dad get you a bass, and you can play with us. And I was just like, oh, all right. So I asked my dad for a bass, and he got me one. Just started jamming like that, you know. And I really only dabbled at first, and then something happened where I just got obsessed with it. I think it was probably Iron Maiden. I really got into Iron Maiden. I would hear the term like, oh, I play by ear. And I remember I was like, what the hell is that? Is that trying it with Iron Maiden? And I was doing it. I was just like, holy shit, like I'm doing it. And it was just addicting. And I haven't stopped since. So,
well, that's a great start for a bass player. Those Steve Harris lines, as far as especially a heavier band like that, they actually mix the bass so you can hear it. So I suppose that's helpful.
Yeah, because when you're that age, you're just like, where is the bass? You know, if it's not loud a lot, like if you're listening to Metallica,
yeah,
you know, you're like, where is the bass? You know, you're struggling. But yeah, when you listen to Iron Maiden, it's like loud and clear because that dude's the boss. So he's like, yeah, no, we're mixing it up. It was fairly easy to like, you know, kind of follow along and pick out some of the stuff he was doing. And then from there, I got into Rush and Yes, and became like a huge, huge Rush geek. And that was like, forget about it. Like, yeah, like there was no turning back after getting into Rush.
Oh, if you're playing bass and you get into Rush, yeah. And what, how can you turn away?
Yeah, how could you? It was just like, no, this is it. Like, this is the dude. Like, talk about, you know, hearing the bass loud and clear and all the cool stuff he's doing and singing at the same time. And just, you know, then I got to see Rush, you know, I saw him on the Presto tour as a little kid. And that was just like, I just kept thinking like, whoa, I'm in the same room with these guys.
Yeah.
Like, they're here. That was just a trip. And when you're like, I think I was 13 when I saw them, when you're that age, it's pretty heavy. It's like, leaves quite an impression on you.
That sounds like a formative experience. I would assume that would cement some fandom. Was it instructive for you as far as seeing a band like Rush live, as far as thinking, I can do this or I want to do that too?
Yeah, it's when you see that you can't help but want to like join in on the fun, because you just see like, wow, like there's like everybody here is just loving this and just like cheering these guys on, and like these guys are like putting on this ridiculous show with like the lasers and rabbits coming out of the side of the stage and shit. It's like, dude, this is amazing. Like, I want to do this.
Whenever there's new Primus music out, do you just enjoy the songs for the first time, or do you try to break down the bass parts right away?
No, I just like want to listen to it and enjoy it. If I really only learn stuff now if I'm like, what the hell is going on there?
Yeah.
Like, what is that? What is going on there? But that doesn't really happen too much nowadays. I know that sounds super arrogant, but
or if you're going to be on a Primus podcast, I hope.
Yeah.
It's a good excuse.
When like the new EP came out, it was just like, oh, here we go, you know, throw it on and just let's see what's going on. Where are these guys at?
Yeah. Oh, well, it's cool that you get to look at it as a fan too, because you are an accomplished musician, you know, from a fan perspective. Yes. From a music perspective, it's all wonderful, a wonderful mystery. So I'm glad you can still wear that hat, I suppose, as a fan of the music. But that directs me to ask you about your path to Primus. So did you get to there through the Rush and the prog stuff you were listening to?
I kind of did. It's kind of an interesting kind of path, I guess. So the first time I laid eyes and ears on Primus was, you know, that Week in Rock special when Les is talking about, like, I'm just a blue-collar guy, that thing. You seen that?
I don't think I have.
You've seen that, Frankie?
Yeah, I recall that.
Okay. Now, I saw that as a kid. You know, it came out on the Week in Rock. It was like a 5-minute little special on this new band called Primus. And they're basically trying to get you to buy Frizzle Fry, you know? And there's some live clips. And I remember seeing that. And I just, for some reason, like, it just struck me when I saw Lur, like, playing behind, they're playing Pudding Time. I didn't know it at the time.
Yeah.
Playing behind the nut, you know? And I remember seeing that going like, whoa, that's crazy. And, you know, just kind of trying to listen, and the credits are going, you know, at the end of the show, and Primus is playing you out. And I didn't know what to think. I mean, it was nuts. I remember going back to school and telling my friends, hey, did you guys see that Primus band on the Week in Rock? And everybody, and one of my friends was like, yeah, yeah, I saw them. They're pretty cool. And I was just like, yeah, yeah, I don't know. Like, we got to check them out. For some reason, I didn't check them out till like maybe it was around. Yeah, it was Seize the Cheese had just come out. And I just got tickets to go see Rush on the Roll the Bones. And Primus is opening up.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my buddies, he would wear a Primus shirt in school, and I remember like saying, "Hey, dude, give me one of your cassettes. I'm gonna go check out this band. They're opening up for Rush," and so he let me borrow Seize the Cheese, and yeah, that was it. And when I threw Seize the Cheese on, I was just like, "Okay, like this is really weird. It was the weirdest music I've ever heard." But I was like, "Dude, there's something here. Like, I just kept listening to it, and I knew I dug it." And I was psyched to see this band, you know, open up for Rush. And I remember I could still see it. Like if it was yesterday, like walking in, getting in my seat and seeing Herb's like gigantic kit there, and seeing Les's like, you know, his cabs and seeing Lur's Marshalls on the side. Like I can totally see it. And, lights go down and Les was wearing the white long johns.
Yeah.
He came out and he's got the braids, which that's my favorite, by the way. I always say Braids Claypool is top for me. Braids Claypool, number one. But yeah, dude, they came out and I think if I recall correctly, they started out with Here They Come, and it was just on. It was just amazing.
They were really heavy back then.
Super heavy, dude. And I had the cheapest seats, but it still sounded great. We were up there and I remember people chanting Primus sucks, you know, and I kind of knew what that meant, but there was other people there that were kind of like, wait, what? You know, they were confused. You know, why are you being so mean to this band kind of thing? And, Yeah, and then I remember that's when they did Kashmir, and that was hilarious because you could tell they were kind of losing the crowd a little bit because I think they might have done tweakers, and you know, people are like, "What the hell is that sound?" You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
They ripped into Kashmir, and the place erupted. It was like, yeah. So that was, I totally remember that. I was like, damn, dude, this is powerful stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because on that tour, I remember that I think Les knew that they were a mixed bag to the crowd at best, I suppose, especially to the diehard Rush fans. So they were playing around a little bit and you just kind of taking the piss at a time or two. So I think that Kashmir tease was part of it to bring people back.
Totally, dude. He knew, like, when he's like, okay, we're kind of losing him a little bit, and then like they just punched it and the place erupted. And it was just like, all right, we got him back, and you know, put in time, and Jerry was the driver, and we're out of here. Yeah, dude, that was it. Like, just completely changed my life. Like, for me, there's like before Primus and after Primus. Like after Primus, I just started listening to everything. Like there was no like judgment or anything. I was just like, I want to find the weirdest stuff. I want to find just, you know, it was just so life-changing for me. Yeah. It was amazing.
Well, we had similar paths in that regard because that was the door for me. Primus was the door, and I walked through it, and the world of weird music was there. And much of it was connected to Primus. When I think about acts that came before them, with your Residents and your Rushes, which I thought Rush was weird enough. I was into it. But then there's just so much out there beyond that. And Primus was my gateway drug, I suppose, to weird music or obnoxious music that alienated my family for years and years. So you also have that bass guitar in your lap. So I want to ask you this. How did seeing Rush and then Primus essentially... Let me ask that again. How did seeing Rush, but also seeing Primus, inform your bass playing as a young man?
Well, it was cool because those two guys are completely different animals. And like, I already knew, you know, what Geddy was kind of doing and trying to emulate him and stuff and his tone. And, then comes Les and it's like, what the, like, he's like, drumming, you know, doing this whole strumming thing, you know, because I'm at that point, you know, a lot of people were doing the slap and pop, as they were calling it, and I've seen that, you know, but then it's like, well, this dude's not doing it like that. It doesn't sound like Flea, you know. Yeah. It doesn't sound funky, you know. He's not in a funk band, this guy, you know. It's like this sounds completely like Les Claypool. It sounds completely, it's an original thing. And, yeah, just learning now, it was just like, okay, now I got to learn like what this guy's doing with this whole right hand deal, you know, the strumming and, you know, popping the string and all this stuff. And it was just like so much action in the right hand where it was just so game changing. And it was awesome because it built up my rhythm chops, like just in general.
And that hand eye coordination, I'm sure, was fine tuned by imitating that or trying out those bass lines, I imagine.
Oh yeah, man. Yeah, for sure. It's just like, I remember getting Frizzle Fry like literally a couple days after that concert and just, you know, boom, it was on. I was just like, I'm going to learn everything off this record and just, you know, trying to, it's like you're like squinting. You're like, I think he's doing this. You know, I think this is what he's doing.
Yeah.
Just trying to, you know, trying to make heads or tails of it.
Yeah. And I think that informs your ear. And KO last week was talking about that to a degree where he would get really crappy tabs off the internet and then figure the rest out by ear, find out what was wrong with those tabs, which was probably 90% of it. And maybe that helped fine tune his ear. And maybe that was working for you too. And I remember trying to learn things by ear, and it was mostly going, that's not right. And then not getting it right 97 times and then stumbling upon what was mostly right the 98th time.
That's how it is, man. You're just like, yeah. It's ear training, you know? Yeah, your ear is definitely guiding you. It's kind of, you're your own worst critic, and your ear's going like, nah, not yet, almost, you know, don't give up.
Well, it's very informative, and it definitely works out. Sounds like it worked for you. I mean, you're playing with a Beatle kid.
Yeah, right on.
Well, once again, thank you for being here. Thank you for telling us or giving us some background. It's really great that you're here to talk about More on TV. And before we dive too far into it, I remember when we were talking about this record and I suggested More on TV, you jumped at the chance. So in general, what are some of your thoughts on this track before we really get into the specifics?
Well, what jumped out to me is definitely the groove. It's just that, you know, just... it almost sounds like a Metallica riff, you know, if you were just to like take it out of context. It's just like, it's pretty, like, it's kind of, it's got that thrashy thing. It's like he's doing James Hetfield on his bass, you know. If it was palm muted and like super distorted on a guitar, it would kind of sound like Metallica. And that's what got me right away. I was just like, oh dude, yeah, okay, like this is, They're doing this, you know. Anytime they're like getting into something different and it's like got a sweet groove to it, I'm just like, I'm all in. And I love the way it starts too, with that, just, you know.
No, that pull off's so cool, yeah.
Like that's just like, it gets your attention right away.
Yeah. As we often do when we introduce the weekly track, this time More on TV. 4 minutes, 38 seconds. On the record, music is credited to Claypool, Lane, Lalonde, all three of them this time. We talk about live history, though. Frankie, it's time for your essay. Blas, get comfortable.
All right. This is another Green Nogahive track that was premiered in Indianapolis at the Murat Theater. And it remained in heavy rotation throughout 2011 all the way through 2014. You know that after the full album performances, some tracks did not come back into heavy rotation, but More on TV is one of the tracks that stuck around. Even in 2014, you know, when there was that switch when Jay left the band and Tim Alexander joined, the song still had quite a bit of play. The same thing throughout 2015. And after that, it kind of started to become more scarce. There are some performances here and there throughout 2017 and 18, and the last performance to date took place in Santiago de Chile in 2019. So it's kind of been a while since we have More on TV live.
Oh, so that one has not survived the post-COVID yet. So I should say that again. That one has not survived COVID. More on TV didn't make it out to the other side
it
yet. Okay,
didn't
maybe
make
they're
it.
Saving it.
And I have a couple of short quotes for you. The first one comes from Les. He said, "There's one song we have in particular called More on TV that was off the last record where the middle section is very much Rush, and it's a homage to those guys. I helped induct them into the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame." And the other quote is from Lur, and he said, "Yeah, there was a lot of riffs around. There are still a lot around that didn't get used on this album, and hopefully they will end up on the future one. I always write stuff, and there were some riffs that I was like, if I were doing a Primus record, this would be a perfect riff. The song Gillies on Smack probably had that riff for 4 or 5 years. Internal Consumption Engine is another one that I've had around for a while. And I had More on TV sitting around for a few years waiting to go on a Primus record."
I want to talk about that Lur comment first, and that's the main lick that we hear from him. I didn't look for it yet, but I swear on Tour de Fromage, possibly Hallucinogenetics, during the jam section of, I believe, a performance of Nature Boy, he throws that lick in there. So it goes back at least to Aught 3, Aught 4. It's somewhere in there. Somebody noticed it a long time ago, and I don't want to go combing through it, but I'm sure one of our crack researchers, who doesn't get paid, I'm telling you that right now, listeners, we'll find it for us. That one's been around for a while, but I don't recall that quote about the middle section being a Rush tribute. That's fascinating.
Absolutely, right?
Blas, are you hearing Rush in that middle section?
Now that you mention it, Frankie, yeah. It's just the way it gets real majory. You know, it goes into the A major and then into this. The next chord is another major chord. That's, yeah, it... Now that you mention it, yeah, I could see it. Yeah.
I could. It sounds like a really roundabout way to get there, but I suppose it is. And I'll leave that to the Rush experts such as yourself, Blaz. I really hope you get to go to the King show. You're going to enjoy the hell out of it as a huge Rush fan, by the way.
Oh, man. Yeah, I hope. Yeah.
All right. So this one, too, as far as live performances, this one, if I recall correctly, when they were playing on the Guinea Pig tour and those Naugahyde sets, this was a real rocker. It was really loud and I think a little bit of a faster pace to it. But then this version that we get on the record is kind of the creepy cousin to me. It's more boxed in as far as the sound goes. It seems a little more restrained, yes. Maybe a little more plodding.
Yes, okay. And it's also one of the tracks that they explored in a live setting, you know, where they got to expand some sections and do some jamming.
Yes. Yeah, looking at these time codes, it looks like they were in the 6.5-7 minute region on some of these live cuts of Moron, yeah.
And it's interesting that the track survived the departure of Jay Lane, because we can actually compare how he did it and how Tim Alexander adapted the song to his playing.
Absolutely. We're going to take a look at a few specific spots, I think, for that. And I should say, even though I called it the Creepy Cousin, I don't think that's a complaint. It's another interpretation of the tune. And so far, as we dive deep into these tunes, I think this is my number one track on the record. So that's where I am with Moron TV right now. Frankie's giving me some side eye, but that's okay.
Oh, that's interesting.
They're not. I know it's not Hennepin Crawler, Frankie, but it's a damn good tune. But to me, it also strikes me, and Blaz, I want to hear your thoughts on this. It strikes me as a complete track. It's got a really nice structure, distinct sections. It sounds very inspired, but composed. And I'm curious your thoughts on that.
That's exactly what I thought, too. It sounds inspired. You know, it's really hard to write a good, simple riff. Like, that is tough, dude. You know, how do you write Smoke on the Water? You know, it's like, how do you do that? What? That shit's like comes from the heavens, you know? And Les is really good at writing like just simple riffs that stick. And when I heard that Moron TV, the Moron TV riff, I was just like, yeah, this is it. Like, that's a great riff. Just everybody hop on the riff, you know, Jay, just lay it down, Lur, do your thing. Like, yeah, that's it. That's awesome. That's so catchy and amazing.
That first main lick that we get, we know that Larry had that lick sitting around for a long time. So, but what Les matches to it is pretty rad. And I think this is the pseudo Metallica part you were talking about, which is what I'm going to call it into eternity now. Let's listen to that. And then if you don't mind breaking it down for us, Blaz, that'd be fantastic. What a great way to start a track, man.
Yeah. Heavy. Okay. Well, right off the bat there, he's like pulling off on the, it's an E minor kind of vibe, with some odds and ends, you know, like Primus always does. So yeah, what we're hearing is just him pulling off on the G string. It's going from E to G, and he's just doing this. It's just such an aggressive thing to do on the G string, just the, and then just ripping right into the E minor kind of riff. You know, that thing is just so heavy and fun to play. So
yeah.
Come, everybody, let's party.
The way that strumming pattern, hearing it isolated, you mentioned Metallica, that's somewhat reminiscent of the last half or the last part of Seek and Destroy, that kind of that strumming pattern.
That's why I refer to it as like the Metallica kind of thing, because that's what I hear too.
Oh, nice. Just for reference, what are you hammering on right now? What are you playing? What kind of bass?
This Fender Ultra Precision bass that Fender was so nice to give to me.
Well, I guess when you're making Fender videos, they want you to play Fender basses. I suppose that makes sense.
They're just like, hey, you want to do a video? I'm like, yeah. And they're like, here's a bass. And then they never ask for it back.
Yeah. Apologize later, right?
Mm-hmm.
Looks like you got a room full of them, actually. Good for you.
Yeah, dude. I have to say no sometimes.
Yeah. You only have so much space.
Yeah. I don't want them in the garage, you know?
That chord strumming, it does sound nice and heavy. Although, once again, this is like the Creepy Cousin. So the bass is compressed, really, it's very mid-rangey. And I've kind of complained about that before, but hearing it full tone in the way that you're playing it, we can hear some of the finer points, and it sounds great. It is definitely a heavy thing. And then we kind of get into a preview of that verse, and we get that, or I guess that bass line there. And this, to me, is another simple line, but it sets everything up here. I really like actually that mid-range there, because it sounds like a truffle hog sniffing around looking for some of those things underground.
Love it. Definitely. I think they're just like, well, we got this heavy riff. Let's just do a variation on it. Let's bring it down. And it's almost like, you know, they go into the whole reggae kind of vibe on it. And it's just another E minor sort of deal. Just a... And then this next part, it's the really weird kind of tension builder. It goes down to like a B flat, and then all the way up to the F sharp, that thing. So it's just like you go from this kind of tonality, and then down there. So it's a cool tension builder, man. I love it. And I don't know if you guys, that little lick that he does, have you heard that before?
Should bells be ringing in my head right now?
Should be ringing. This is what it reminded me of. The
Oh.
He does that lick quite a few times. I know he's done it another few times, but that's a total Claypoolism.
Oh, a Claypoolism. I like that. We've been saying Claypoolian. I'm going to start using Claypoolism. That's a good one. Okay, yeah. So yeah, it does sound like it would fit right into toys. So good call, man. I don't think I would have made that connection.
Yeah, when I heard that, I was like, oh, there's one of those little twiddly D's that he does. Do-do-do-do-do.
It's kind of cool that it turns up in more than one track if you're listening closely. It's okay for musicians to repeat themselves to a degree, or to have little darlings like that they'll sprinkle in here and there. You know, because Larry will go above the nut more than just on Pudding Time. He's done it here and there. It's a great little accent. And I suppose if you're listening closely, you can say, there's a Claypoolism, or there's a Lurism.
Right. Yeah. I remember Neil Peart talking about that in an interview, saying like, there does have to be a little bit of, you know, repeating yourself in order to kind of like get that stuck in people's brains that like, this is what I do. This is my style. You know, and I was just kind of like, oh, okay, you know, put that in the old pocket, you know, remember that.
Yeah, slightly off topic, but do you have any of your own blazisms that you know of?
I tend to do this a lot, like... Can you guys hear that?
Uh-huh.
I do a lot of raking kind of stuff where... That sort of thing. I guess. I mean, I'm sure there's a bunch of other stuff, but you know, you put me on the spot here, Jeff.
I know, man. Turning one's mind back on oneself can be a useful exercise, I suppose, especially in music, to know what you're doing and who you are as a musician. There's a lot of Frankieisms on this podcast that people love. So, Blazisms, Joshisms, we've all got our isms.
Blaz, you mentioned a moment ago. That reggae vibe, and I agree completely. And I believe some of that comes directly via what Lur is doing with the guitar during the verses, right? While Liz is singing the verses. And that's something, I mean, that's a resource that Larry uses on a lot of Prima songs, actually.
Right. Yeah. He's a skanker, that Lur.
What I appreciate about the skanking this time around is he's matching some of the bass notes of that lick that you modeled for us. So if I play a few seconds and we just listen to Lur skanking, I think he's following Les's pattern.
Face with cheddar balls. As my brain cells start to pop, she licks her fingers, stares away. Her IQ slowly drops. A prima as best I can from that electric stand.
Oh, for sure.
For sure, yeah.
Josh, I want to highlight my favorite part. Can you please play 2:47?
I can, because I marked it myself. Oh, yeah, this part. I'm calling this part Funk City. I want to hear definitely both your guys' thoughts on this part here. Man, I'm just not that steeped in Rush to hear it. So, Blaz, talk us through it.
I think the reason, and it doesn't sound anything like Rush. I think the only reason they would call it the Rush part is just because how majory it kind of sounds. Something like Spirit of Radio and, those kinds of like major chords that like they're kind of known for. That's about it. But it's a weird part for this song to go into that heavy riff and then the way it goes into this, it's pretty bizarre, but it's Primus.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting because, for example, with Eyes of the Squirrel and Gilly, the breakdown goes into like this dark territory, right? And More on TV becomes very upbeat. It's like a whole different song during the breakdown.
And Blaz, you pointed out those major chords. It does sound much brighter coming out of that heavier section. And the other thing is, Jay is largely playing it straight, kind of a straight ahead rock beat when we have our main riff. And then the reason I called it Funk City is because you listen to Jay. I mean, just listen to what Jay's doing. He's playing Jay Lane things all of a sudden, and it's funky as all hell between that and the bass. So I'll play just a few measures of and just listen to Jay here and listen to the horrible crimes he's committing against the hi-hat. What's the evil man? Love that. And Blast, you have a beat on the bass there because he's going up a register and doing something just strange sounding.
He's doing this sort of like a thing way up on the, up on the A 12th fret kind of area, just doing it.
And that part you just played is where they will extend it live. And so Les will kind of play that, I don't know, arpeggio or something. I don't know exactly what he's playing there. You do, Blast. But that's where he'll space it out some and give Larry space to solo.
Right. I've seen that summer camp video with Herb playing. And
The legendary summer camp video.
Oh, I love that one, man. I love hearing Herb play this song. It feels so Herb. I'm Team Herb. I love that dude.
I think it's definitely one of the best performances of More on TV, and not just because it's professionally recorded footage, but I mean just the performance of the track itself is fantastic. Well, first of all, in case any of our listeners have not watched this performance, you have to rectify that as soon as possible. Summer Camp Sessions, Primus performing More on TV, 2014. First of all, it was directed by Jay Blakesberg, whom we talked to on the show before, and he did a really superb job. I mean, there are so many different angles. You get a lot of action from all three band members. Tim Alexander is playing this enormous white drum set, which is just really impressive. The tone of the performance is also incredible, and we get a rare sight of Les Claypool with a ponytail.
Right.
Well, you mentioned Jay Blakesberg, and we said this to him, that he knows how to cut it up just right for Primus, so he knows when to put the focus on Lesler or Tim, whoever the drummer is in that moment in time, I should say. But he knows when to cut to them, because he knows the music so well.
I agree with you, Josh. Yeah. Exactly. Jay knows the songs. He knows the band. It would be really amazing if he recorded a full show, for example.
Wow, yeah.
I'm into it. Let's get him.
Where do I sign? Let's get that petition.
Blaz first on the list. Love it. First of all, I want to thank you, Blaz, for modeling this stuff, because once again, the the production to me leaves a little bit to be desired as far as if they did this one full blown like they do live, I think it would just sound huge. But they go for the creepy cousin, which is not a problem at all. I think it works. But there's a lot of little things, and you're pointing out some of these things that's going on. And I want to rewind a little bit to me, this just sounds like great songwriting. You know, every once in a while, and I'm sure, Blaz, you can speak to this, you're putting together a song and you think, I got my A part and my B part, or my B part and my C part, and I need something in between. And so for this particular transition, this is what they came up with. This thing right here is my favorite thing. They just let it go with some cool effects. Why not? It sounds simplistic, but it really lets it breathe, and Jay gets to establish the groove. So
Les loves that effect. He uses it live all the time.
He sure does. It's very spacey and nebulous, so it's hard to get a handle on it.
No, that's cool that you point that out, Josh, because I thought the same thing. I love when Primus gets into their songwriting, maybe we should say less, because, yeah, just them going into that boing, you know, just giving it that space that it is. That's what you call songwriting right there. It's like you have all your parts. It's like you don't that's one of the things you want to do is you don't want to like, okay, let me write another part, you know, let me throw more stuff at you. It's like, well, you already have all these parts. Let's just, you know, work with those. And that's pretty awesome right there. It's like, they're letting you know, it's like, okay, we're going into this other realm, you know, and we're not going to hit you over the head with it. You know, just boom, you're in another room. Here you go. You know, get used to it. It's like, we're going to ease our way into it. And, we're just going to, you know, it's like you're traveling. You got a couple of you're taking the scenic route.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like taking the off ramp from the interstate onto a state highway or something. You know, you get the transition. It's not abrupt. You get to veer off, slow down, take your turn, and then you're there into that part.
Yeah, it's great. And then you're like, boom, once that next little riff comes in, it's like, okay, cool. Yeah, we're good. You know, you're not bombarded. You're not hit over the head.
And I really enjoy how all the elements of the track come together for the conclusion. I mean, it's like the introduction is also the ending of the track. I mean, it's the same elements, just like different notes, right?
But yeah.
It builds very briefly into that conclusion, and it's very exciting to listen to it.
There's a couple of things near the end, because they have to get out of the Funk City part. And so they do something really great. Where they give us this soundscape again, but then we get the classic Primus stop-start. And that's how they transition to the last part. And having the bottom drop out of it just seems like the right thing to do there for dramatic effect. And I would love to play it. And we're back into it. That's just great songwriting right there.
That's awesome. Love it.
I always go back to my absolute favorite Primus track, which is Year of the Parrot, which I will admit is messy. It doesn't have these kind of brilliant transitions, but it's still my absolute favorite Primus track. But I can appreciate to a very high degree, because I still believe this is my favorite track off of Green Augahyde, that they can do this kind of thing, and it is so compelling and shows that when they take the time and the effort and the care to do it, they can structure some brilliant songs. I'm really into this one. Let's talk about Lure a little bit. I think this did originate with that riff, Frankie, that you had mentioned, and that's a killer riff. Now, he didn't have the Bubbletron at that point, but it sounds very Bubbletron-y to me, so he, of course, is the king of pedals and weird effects. He finds something that sounds really good for that lick. We talked about how Les is matching it with those chords underneath. Is that a Bubbletron you're holding up there, Blaz?
It's not a Bubbletron, but it's a vibrato. It's a vibrato pedal, and it sounds like I'm an absolute pedal fiend, so huge fan of the pedals. But yeah, it sounds like Lur's rocking the vibrato with the some Univibe, maybe. It sounds like he's stacking a bunch of stuff just to make it wobble like that.
Now, I was messing around because I ordered a Bubbletron and was lucky enough to get one.
Nice.
Nice.
And I was just screwing around, and it actually made me get out my electric guitar because I said, well, I spent $200 on this thing. I better use it. So I'm just screwing around with the settings. I made a sound, and I thought, maybe this is the more on TV one. And we were talking about just learning by ear, but I guess some of these things are just so ingrained in our heads. Well, for me, at least, it's these Primus songs that I think I was able to suss out that main lick just because I heard the sound that, you know, I associated with his guitar on this track. Good call, Blaz. I'm sure you've got it.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like to me. It sounds like he's, you know, going for the maximum wobble. And I think that isn't that what a bubbletron is? It's kind of like.
Yeah, you've got phaser, you've got flange, you've got envelope filter. There's a couple other things you have to open it up to activate, but you've got all those settings. And of course you can. I think there's four different dials on there, so you can just mess with it to your heart's content.
Yeah, so I think this was the, you know, the precursor to that, where when Lara was just stacking stuff, and it sounds like, yeah, vibrato, some phaser, some univibe, some, yeah, a bunch of stuff.
I love the sound. And I should point out, I do think, and I've said this before, I think the production does limit the depth to which we get to hear it. I want to go back to that transition before the very end when they get back into the main riff, because Larry just hits some notes and we hear this sound, and it's panning a little bit and it's definitely flanging. But I think with a more depth of sound, we'd hear more of what was going on there. Right here. Because it sounds like he's just emptying the bucket or pressing every button he can.
He's just like, all right, let's stack them.
We're going to space. It's wonderful. So we talked about the skanking. You know, he's given us a lot of little fills here and there, taking up space when need be. It's just really nice songwriting around this. And I think Larry, his fingerprints are all over this one, too. I don't know if they give themselves enough time in the studio to write really good, solidly structured songs for every single track, or if they want to be more extemporaneous in the way that they create them. But, you know, if you gave them enough time to sit down and write, you know, I'm thinking about Frizzle Fry, where those songs had been crafted for many years. You know, if they did the same thing with the Naugahyde material, I think we'd have a different sounding album. But this one would probably be the same.
I think you're right. This one's pretty well crafted, yeah.
Couple notes on the drums. Blaz, as a bass player, you probably have plenty to say about drummers, and I'm saying that positively. I'm not putting a skew on that, because bassists and drummers have to be in lockstep and have to know each other. I will say this, though. I think Jay is on the main part. He's a little more restrained. We do get some nice flourishes, but I think the production also restrains what it sounds like. But our friend Matt Hunter said, if you get some good headphones, boost your bass on the EQ, you can get some really nice drum sounds out of it. I got a little bit of thunder messing around that way. And even though Jay's kind of playing it straightforward on the main parts, I really love the idea. You talked about the kind of the reggae part where he goes to the rim of the snare during the verses, and that really brings it down. And then, you know, that means there's just more power to it when he goes back to the straight ahead rock beat for the main lick. I don't know, it just makes things more dynamic. But then when we get into Funk City, we get Jay Lane unleashed and doing Jay Lane things too, so there's a great contrast. And I think my favorite thing, even though it's covered up by the vocals, would be the danga danga dang dang part where Jay's just letting loose and hitting every cymbal he's got. Really great part. But and that reminds me, before anybody knew the name of this song on that guinea pig tour, it was just referred to as Bang, Bang, Bang. But so, Blaz, drummers. I mean, speak to us about Jay Lane, but also what you hear him bringing to the table on this track.
Like you always mentioned, Josh, yeah, just hi-hat city with Jay Lane. What he's bringing to this track is just tightness. You know, it's like that hi-hat is just locked in, and it's just, you know, just giving us that steady flow. And he's like keeping it all tight for everybody to like do their thing. And there's some stuff. There's that one drum fill that actually on that one spot that you pointed out, Josh, the little transition spot. There's that's a pretty sick Jay Lane drum fill. If you want to play that real quick so we can hear that.
that's a good one.
Yep, there it is, man. That's Jay just being a beast.
What, you know, when you're playing with drummers, what are you looking for as far as communication and rhythm and that sort of thing? And
first and foremost is just steadiness. You want a drummer that's just sounds like they have fresh batteries. You know, like those batteries are fresh. They're not wavering. Like that's pretty much numero uno. And then I'm all about creativity, and that's why I love guys like Tim and Jay so much, because I mean, especially someone like Tim, I mean, the dude's just so outside of the box. He composes. He's not just playing beats. And that's what I love playing with drummers that are composers. They're like playing parts. They're, you know, writing things that they're feeling, you know, that they're listening to what you're doing and they're vibing off that, and they're going to write something off of that and vice versa. And it just creates this like feedback of creativity. And that's what I've always, you know, looked for in drummers is just got to be steady, but let's be like super creative and outside of the box too. Mm-hmm.
There's one thing that jumped out at me on this track as we were preparing for this. Frankie, I think you pointed out there was a previous track where we could hear an obvious cut. Wasn't it in Carpenter?
Yes, there's a click after the bridge.
I think I heard an obvious Pro Tools cut or something in this one too. But it's only when I was listening on really nice headphones in a very quiet place and really concentrating on the tune. So I'm going to play about 10 seconds here. You tell me. If you can hear the obvious cut, it's going to be, I'm going to play about 5 seconds before and after. Right after the Moron TV?
Yeah. So it wasn't my CD skipping all these years.
Oh. No, that's got to be an obvious cut, right? They covered it, I think, with that splash cymbal, but it was jarring to me, actually, when I was really listening closely. It's not slapdash, because they took their time and care on this, but I'm curious your thoughts.
You know what? That's the thing. I really don't know, because, man, sometimes you are thinking, like, why would they just do that? Why not just, like, take it again? But, I mean, we hear the stories of you know, Les say like, ah, that's good. You know, like people in his band going like, oh, let me do that over again. And he's like, nope.
You get your Les voice on lockdown too, man. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. It just leaves me wondering as to why not just do it again? Like get a better take. And that way you don't have to do so much editing, or I have no idea.
But, well, I will say they covered it pretty well, because I'm pretty sure this is the first time I've noticed it, and it's been 11 years since this album came out, and I've listened to it plenty of times.
You really have to listen for it. I wouldn't have noticed if you wouldn't have mentioned it. You kind of have to squint your ears for it.
And now it's one
just
of those,
ruined it, Josh, for everyone.
Yeah, I know I did. It's one of those things where you didn't notice a goof up in a movie, and then somebody pointed it out to you, and you see it every time now. Oh, let's talk about the vocals. The vocals are interesting, and I think they're strong. And I've said it before, Les can really flow as a vocalist. But he's also having fun with the tones and his delivery. He gives us that really low register, Moron TV. And it's at the last repetition of each chorus there. We get a nasal one, I think. Frankie, your favorite delivery, buried in the mix as he's a chorus of himself doing the Moron TV. There's got to be Moron TV. We get the bullet mic with the verses, but I also think he's given us a little bit of that vocal fry. I'm not a huge fan of vocal fry, especially on podcasts, but in music, it can be used to great effect. And I really think he's getting down there doing that, she feeds her face with cheddar balls and that sort of thing. So he's getting that fry going. And I really think when he's delivering these verses, he's given us a lot of great syncopation on the vocals. It seems like he's kind of stressing the fourth syllable every time. I might be hearing this wrong. But when I look at that second stanza, just when I thought I'd seen it all, they pull a cretin from the shelves. So he's giving us that accent on the last syllable of those phrases. I think these are some of his stronger vocals as far as delivery on the record as well.
I mean, I also quite enjoy the vocal layering. I mean, I I've always championed Les experimenting with his vocals ever since Sinister Exaggerator.
He's taking a lot more, and you also pointed out, I think, around Oysterhead time, he started getting more adventurous.
Yeah, I think like we discussed during Antipop, I think Stewart really gave him a push to consider himself a singer and not a narrator.
Yeah, and we see it all over this record, but here we get some really strong examples of that. As we discuss the lyrics here, I want to point to the Relics interview that Les did with his son Cage around the time of those NFTs coming out, among other things, and they did this whole interview around Tribute to Kings, this, that, and the other thing. Specifically from that interview is that Les, as a dad, and it's great that we're recording this on Father's Day, he kind of controlled the programming for his kids as far as their screens. He must have been pretty concerned about the TV not raising them, for one, but also making sure that what they saw was acceptable. The title of this tune says it all. There's plenty of morons on TV, and most of it is pretty debasing and not at all edifying or uplifting. So I recall him saying, I only really let my kids watch classic movies and classic TV shows. Because I think around this time when he's writing these lyrics, they're teenagers. He's very careful about the programming that they see, and I think that's to his credit. I think parents should be really careful about what their kids are seeing. This must have been a real concern for him. But I also love, to me, there's a bit of irony with placing more on TV, in which he just rails against all the crapola on TV right after Lee Van Cleef, in which he, I guess, waxes nostalgic about some of his favorite movies when he was a kid. And you can be damn sure that a lot of those Westerns and movies that he was watching when he was a kid were probably maligned by the adults as the time as being trash. So, because there's a generational thing too, right? The grown-ups want to protect their kids, or they say, wow, that's going way too far. It wasn't like that when I was a kid. But with the lyrics, we get these really long couplets in the verses, in contrast with very short lines in the chorus. More on TV. There's got to be more on TV than just more on TV. That's your chorus.
Yeah.
Once again, really,
I want to know what you think, Josh, because what I noticed from those lyrics is that, I mean, the first verse actually has a repetition of she fits her face with cheddar balls. So it's like Les really wanted to emphasize that fact. And the second verse, compared to the first one, it's actually pretty poetic. I mean, there are some very complicated sentences there. Apostle gutter troll. Mm-hmm. Fill our coffers full of gold. I mean, that's quite elaborate. As you mentioned, the chorus is quite simple. I actually recall some contemporary reviews when the album came out that criticized the pun in the chorus, but I always found it pretty charming, to be honest. And the final verse, I mean, during the bridge, before we reach the final set of choruses, that one I think is reminiscent of what he did on Eyes of the Squirrel, where he's just grabbing from all over the place regarding pop culture. I mean, We could speculate about what he's talking about, but in reality, it could be many different people at the same time.
We can definitely go down the list of that grab bag here. For sure. But I do want to point to those first two verses. We do get some really great descriptive language. And I'm glad you pointed out the repetition of she feeds her face with cheddar balls, because I think what he's doing is equating stuff in your face with food while you're watching TV to what's happening up here in your brain as you're watching TV. It's being stuffed with junk. She feeds her face with cheddar balls as my brain cells start to pop. There it is right there. I'm losing brain cells watching this. She licks her fingers, stares away, her IQ slowly drops, so there's that comparison again. I pry my eyes as best I can from the big electric stain. There's that descriptive and metaphorical language, big electric stain. He could just say, I'm trying not to look at the screen, but he calls it a big electric stain and gets a really nice rhyme out of it when he finishes with, she feeds her face with cheddar balls and stuffs more nonsense to her brain. And then we really get a lot more visuals with the second stanza. Just when I thought I'd seen it all, they pull a cretin from the shelves and flash that filth under the nails to make us feel better about ourselves. So flashing the filth under the nails, that's where we're seeing every little detail and character flaw of this person as they are, I don't know, doing what? Their daily tasks, having horrible relationship issues, trying to get a visa for their fiance. I don't freaking know, but debasing others to make ourselves feel superior. And then that second couplet, as they ooze across the screen like a pustule gutted troll, that's a nasty image, and I love it. I think it's, I'm glad you pointed it out, Frankie. It's a fantastic visual where he could just say something, he could say something completely different, but ooze across the screen, nice and gross. Last line, we fill their coffers full of gold and praise the skill of asshole. I didn't put the enunciation on it correctly. Praise the skill of asshole is how he says it on the record. You pointed that one too, Frankie. Fill their coffers full of gold. Instead of saying they're getting rich off of us, he's saying we are the ones filling their coffers full of gold because we're watching this shit and people are paying to advertise on it. I love that line. Praise the skill of asshole. We're holding up these people as if they are worthy of it. And then contrast that with more on TV. There, you know, the pun. And I think it's an all right pun. It's a little obvious, but it, once again, it's Father's Day, so let's call it a dad joke. Well, let's look at the Funk City part. You guys can fill in the blank. You can name the person. I love the repetition of that one. He doesn't give names, so he leaves it somewhat ambiguous, but we can probably name who
interesting.
They are.
Okay, let's see what comes to our minds.
Yeah, so put your brain back in 2010. That one's famous for a sex tape. Who would that be?
Paris Hilton.
That's one possibility. I was thinking, what's her face, Kardashian, but maybe the timing's
Kim Kardashian.
That could be it. The second one, that one's famous for her dad.
Kim Kardashian.
All of these are Kardashians.
I would say Kardashian, yeah.
Okay. I wouldn't say no, but my mind went to Miley Cyrus.
Oh, good point.
I think that's around the time of Hannah Montana and that daughter, Billy Ray Cyrus. So she had a leg up. That one had more babies than anyone's ever had. He's already he already took a dig at this lady on the record. Fourth one, that one married a rock star that made all the little girls squeal.
2010.
Eddie Brickell, the wife of Paul Simon.
Oh, Edie Brickell.
Yeah.
Let's go with it. You guys know more than me. The last one, that one wants to be president because she's got moron appeal.
That's got to be Sarah Palin, right?
Given less is politics and history, yes. Although some people might argue it's Hillary Clinton.
Good point.
I would say that he's referring to Sarah Palin. And it's and because of the Moran appeal part, you know, he's already taken digs at her lyrically in his own chronology on the Fungi and Folk
Red State Girl.
Exactly. So it's quite naked anymore that their ambitions are to win elections. That's the whole point of political parties. So when they create their presidential tickets, what they're trying to do is utilize or exploit as many demographics as they can. You know, choosing a female running mate now is actually strategy as opposed to, it's so fucking cynical. It's like all based on strategy and demographics as opposed to the best person for the job. You're never going to get the best person for the job nominated by these major political parties. It's awful. You know, just that line, she's got moron appeal. There's a reason he put that in there. They're trying to appeal to a certain demographic to get their vote. That's all I'm going to say about it before I get too angry. He's making a very insightful comment in just a few words there, which I find satisfying.
Appeal, that's like appealing to the masses, right?
And that's, you know, the lowest common denominator. You often hear that or base language or a baseline appeal. That's code for get the dumb people to get on your side. I know I'm not being kind when I say that, but it's just get the unwashed masses to vote for you. Unfortunately, that's how a lot of politicians view their voters, as just this faceless mass of people that they're just trying to manipulate. But you're absolutely right, Blaz. That's where it's going. I do have a grammar Nazi note, and I apologize for this ahead of time. But when I was reading the lyrics as printed in the booklet, he's got that one had more babies than anyone's ever had. THEN. Oops. It should be than, the preposition THAN. It's a common. Now, I teach sixth grade. That's a common mistake for sixth graders. It's also a common mistake for adults.
Unforgivable.
That's all I've got on More on TV. Any final thoughts on the track, guys, before we look at some live cuts?
I think you summed it up, Josh.
I try to do that every week. And I'm looking forward to these live cuts because, as I've said on this podcast, I don't listen to a lot of live Primus. But this one I know is a really strong live track. So, Frankie, looks like our first one, you have us listening to something from the Guinea Pig Tour.
Cool. What's the place, Josh?
It doesn't say.
Oh, it's a secret. All right. Let's hear it.
This is Primus at a secret location in 2011. That sounds a little bit more aggressive than the record. What are you hearing, Blas?
It's the tempo is definitely a little more just like, you know, in the pocket and just a little slower so you can kind of dig into it. But I'm curious, who's on drums? Is this
hey,
wow. I would think it would be Tim because it's so kind of like it's a little bit more laid back. But man, that's killer. Yeah, I love this.
Yeah, this is where they're gonna stretch a little. That was a heavy fill too, and then I stopped right on his voice crack. That's so embarrassing. So that's not the stretch out part. I was faked out by that, but that was, I love that transition, and I didn't point to that on the studio version, but that's one of my favorite moments too, where they do that unison riff. That sounds great.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's a cool recording for sure.
Your last note says 4:30 up to 6 minutes for Lure leading to outro.
Oh, awesome.
Lure, you can lead me anywhere. This is the stretched out part. Mother of God, that's awesome.
You don't get that in the record.
Man, Lur's just, he can do no wrong.
That's Lur Santana territory.
Exactly. I was going to point out that what Lur was doing there reminds me a lot of what he would do in Groundhog's Day once it became a jam vehicle in Tour de Fromage.
Absolutely.
Yes. Total Groundhog's Day vibes.
I love the groove underneath, too. He's just kind of deconstructing the chords that he plays on the record there. Is that what he's doing, Blas?
Yeah, basically, he's just like, all right, you know, we're just going to shift this riff down here and just kind of, you know, make it a little more sparse and beefy.
I'm going to listen to this one a couple of times, Frankie. Good choice.
Cool.
I question Frankie's second choice, however, because it says, Hi Sierra, intro for Envelope Filter Delight.
Oh, fantastic.
Oh, boy.
I should ask you, Blas, Team Envelope Filter?
I'm with you on this one, Josh. It gets a little much for me, too.
All right. Well, when it's used judiciously, it's fine. But Frankie called it a delight in his notes, and that scares me. So
that's alarming for sure. For
yeah,
you.
Yeah, indeed. Pass.
Just right off the bat, man. I'm stepping on this sucker tonight.
It didn't. I don't hear it enhancing that really cool riff. Unfortunately, it just that didn't work for me.
Yeah, I agree, Josh.
All right, our next one is San Francisco, 2012, Great American Music Hall. Is this January 1st then? Because Anthony and I had this discussion that Great American Music Hall was not New Year's Eve. I think it was January 1st or 2nd, 2012, to start the year.
Great American Music Hall, San Francisco, January 1st, 2012. You're absolutely right.
Nailed it!
Woo!
Yes, indeed. That is, I think I'm at about 6% success rate naming show dates. That's an improvement over the life of this podcast, though. Funk City. You know what I'm liking about this is it sounds just like the record. I love that they can replicate that craziness live and without skipping a beat. It sounds awesome. That was a nice little sample there. And then I'm fast forwarding to a part that Frankie only describes as Lur and Jay. Here's what I think I'm hearing, and I want to hear from you as a musician, not me as a musician. I think I hear Lur and Jay waiting for a cue from Les to transition, and he's not giving it to them. He's just kind of giving them those whole notes. And so Jay is filling the space and continuing, and Lur's continuing. And then Les finally rejoins, and then they can actually go to him for the cue because he's always the guy that calls it back or brings it back.
Yeah, that's kind of what I hear, too, is when Les gives those big whole notes, it's kind of like him signaling, like, fill it up, guys, like, do your thing, you know, I'm giving you the space. And then when he comes back with the busier playing, that's when you know it's like, okay, we're transitioning.
I thought I heard Jay like three times try to transition to the next section, but Les wasn't giving him anything, so they just kept going.
Yeah, he's like, nope, keep going, not done.
That is a funny part. Frankie, that's a good pull.
Glad you enjoyed these selections.
Absolutely. Well, we've got one more. This is Brooklyn 2017, so now we have Tim Alexander on drums.
Oh, let's compare.
And I'm going to be listening for the drums, even though Frankie's note says Lur, so my ears will be divided. Anytime you put Lur on a note, I'm going to listen to Lur, but we should definitely listen to samples of Tim's drumming as well. I'm going to pause it there because that time, Les clearly was leading them to that and then gave them the old so they knew. And so I was listening to Lur. It was Lur Santana, and I freaking loved it. But what I listened to Tim, I heard him doing kind of the Jay Lane thing for the Funk City. Every drummer has a different voice, right? You're all going to have different voicings. So Herb's voicings on the Funk City part are definitely different. But then as they're moving towards the end, he opens it more up and goes to the standard rock beat. And that's Tim Alexander. I can hear
the gorilla.
Gorilla, yeah. Tim yeah. There's a seriousness to his playing, which I've always loved, the juxtaposition between Les and Tim. That chemistry is amazing because it's like you have this serious guy behind the kit and it comes off that way. Like, yeah. You know, like, this is what I play. These are my parts. I'm serious about this. And Les is playing. It comes off a little more playful, you know, and that chemistry is awesome. you know, and you can definitely hear it on that little cut there.
Yeah, that's a great point about how their personalities come through the way that they play. Frankie, nice live cuts, man. Well, I should say this, more on TV, we're pulling the plug because you've been tracked. Next time, Frankie, let's take a ride with the Green Ranger.
Try not to lose the plot, Josh.
I'm known for it. Blaz, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. I know you were under the weather, but this was a great talk. I appreciate it very much, sir.
Blaz, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, guys. It's been an honor. I'm a huge fan, so hope we can do it again.
Absolutely. Where can the good people find you online?
I only have an Instagram, and that's, you can find me with my name, Blas Perez, or my screen name is TurboFace. Hit me up on Instagram. Yeah, totally. Search me. I'm on the YouTubes as well.
Excellent. He's a Fender ambassador.
Yes.
There it is. Now, there's one more thing, Blas. Anytime a bassist comes on here for the first time, they have to play Tommy the Cat.
All right. Is this dedicated to good old Soya?
You bet.
Let's do it. All right, that's what I got.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Sounded good on the Fender, man, on the four banger.
Love it. Thanks, guys.
Hopefully you get the Soya seal of approval on that one. It sounded great.
Oh, man, I'm nervous.
All right, folks, we're out of here. At Primus Tracks on Instagram and Twitter, find Blaz. He's an awesome bass player. Thanks again, Blaz. Later days.
Willie Mace.